Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome, curious learners, to a deep dive into an absolutely singular figure in American history, someone who uniquely shaped our nation by holding not one, but two of its highest offices.
That's right.
When we typically think of U.S. presidents, our focus naturally centers on their time in the White House.
Sure, the Oval Office years.
But what if that was just one fascinating chapter in an even more extraordinary legal and political odyssey, a journey that led them to the pinnacle of both the executive and judicial branches?
Today, we're unpacking the remarkable and often surprisingly nuanced life of William Howard Taft, the 27th President of the United States and, later, the 10th Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
The only one ever.
The only person ever to hold both of these monumental roles. It's a journey brimming with personal ambition, unexpected twists, and a constant wrestle with the balance of power, not just in the government, but maybe within himself, too.
Our mission for you today is to navigate a rich stack of sources, primarily a comprehensive Wikipedia overview of Taft's life, and to extract the pivotal moments and surprising insights that truly define his legacy.
Yeah, we're digging in.
We're going to explore his rapid ascent, the complexities of his presidency, his truly unexpected second act on the Supreme Court, and how historians view him today. We're going to give you that shortcut to truly being well-informed about a man whose impact stretched far beyond the Oval Office.
Definitely.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
So we're starting our journey in Cincinnati, Ohio, where William Howard Taft was born on September 15th, 1857. It's immediately clear he hailed from a family deeply, almost inherently, embedded in public service.
Oh, absolutely.
His father, Alfonso Taft, was quite the prominent figure herself, serving as U.S. Attorney General and Secretary of War under President Ulysses S. Grant. That sets an incredibly high bar for a young man, doesn't it?
It absolutely does, and our sources really emphasize this high-achieving background. The pressure for success, particularly from his demanding parents, was a constant force in the lives of William and his four brothers.
Right.
What's particularly insightful here is that William Howard Taft wasn't necessarily lauded as a brilliant prodigy in his youth, you know, but he was consistently described as a diligent hard worker. This early, almost relentless emphasis on effort over innate genius truly laid the disciplined foundation for his entire career, shaping his methodical approach to administrative and judicial roles later in life.
And he certainly channeled that work ethic at Yale College, which he entered in 1874. While we often associate him with intellectual heavy lifting, our sources delightfully tell us that the heavyset jovial Taft was popular and an intramural heavyweight wrestling champion.
Oh. Yeah, that's a great detail.
He graduated second in his class of 121 in 1878, which again speaks volumes about his dedication and ability to apply himself fully regardless of the challenge.
Exactly. Hard work paying off over perceived genius. And what's also quite a surprising fact for many, and a testament to his family's enduring influence, is his membership in Skull and Bones.
Ah, yes. The secret society.
This exclusive Yale secret society was actually co-founded by his father, Alfonso. This connection links William Howard Taft directly to an influential network that would include future presidents like George H.W. and George W. Bush, suggesting a lineage of power and connection that ran deep from his earliest days.
After Yale, he didn't waste any time entering the legal field. He attended Cincinnati Law School, graduating with an LLB in 1880, but his legal training wasn't confined to the classroom.
No, that's cute.
He also worked on the Cincinnati Commercial newspaper and read law in his father's office. This was crucial. It wasn't just theoretical learning. He was covering local courts, immersing himself in the practical, day-to-day application of the law, gaining invaluable real-world knowledge that went beyond textbooks.
Right, hands-on experience.
He passed the bar easily, which isn't surprising given this hands-on approach.
Indeed, his initial steps into government reflected this blend of practicality and unwavering principle. In October 1880, he served as assistant prosecutor for Hamilton County, Ohio, handling, you know, routine cases. Then, in 1882, President Chester A. Arthur appointed him collector of internal revenue for Ohio's first district. Here's where an early defining sign of his commitment to meritocracy and the rule of law truly emerged. He resigned in March 1883, flat out refusing to dismiss competent employees just for purely political reasons.
Wow. Early on.
Yeah. This signaled, very early on, that his principles would often outweigh political expediency, a theme we'll definitely see repeat.
So right from the start, a commitment to what he believed was right, even if it cost him a position. He wasn't out of the judiciary for long, though.
Not at all.
At just 29 in 1887, he was appointed to a vacancy on the Superior Court of Cincinnati and later elected for a full five-year term. He was on a very fast track, demonstrating remarkable competence and a clear path forward.
And it was during this time, in 1889, that he issued a significant legal opinion in Moores & Covey Bricklayers Union No. 1, ruling a union's secondary boycott illegal.
Okay, labor unions.
This raises an important question for us. How did this early ruling on labor unions foreshadow later challenges to his judicial philosophy? It showed a consistent interpretation of what was permissible under the law, and it would certainly become a point of contention that resurfaced during his more prominent political career. It's a key glimpse into his judicial temperament, really.
Beyond his public career, his personal life was also taking shape. He married Helen Herron, known to many as Nellie, in 1886.
Nellie, a major influence.
Clearly a force of nature, described as highly ambitious for her husband, sometimes critical, and playing a very significant, almost driving role in his career trajectory. They went on to have three children, including Robert, who would become a prominent U.S. senator himself.
It's absolutely crucial to note that even at the age of 32, a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court was already his professional goal.
Yeah.
He actively sought an appointment in 1889, but felt it was unlikely, given the limited vacancies. Yet that ambition remained a powerful underlying current throughout his entire life, a guiding star that he would eventually reach, but not without significant detours.
His rapid ascent continued when he was appointed Solicitor General by President Benjamin Harrison in 1890. This role seems to have been a perfect fit for his meticulous and systematic nature.
It really does.
He quickly cleared a backlog of cases and, crucially, immersed himself in federal law and procedure, which he hadn't needed to master as an Ohio state judge. He truly made that role his own.
He proved incredibly effective, winning 15 of the 18 cases he argued before the Supreme Court. It's a pretty good record.
Not bad at all.
But what's truly fascinating and a testament to his commitment to justice was a significant policy innovation he introduced in 1891, the Confession of Error policy.
Explain that a bit.
This meant the U.S. government would actually concede a case in the Supreme Court that it had won at a lower court if the Solicitor General genuinely believed the government should have lost.
So admitting they were wrong even after winning.
Exactly. This policy, which prioritizes justice over simply winning, remarkably continues to this very day, revealing a foundational integrity that guided his every decision.
That's quite something. But that Supreme Court ambition was still calling.
Always there.
He resigned as Solicitor General in March 1892 to accept a lifetime appointment to the newly created Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, seeing it as a more direct, perhaps surer, path to the Supreme Court.
Calculated move.
These years, from 1892 to 1900, were reportedly a period of personal and professional contentment, a comfortable life supplemented by his wealthy half-brother, Charles. It seems he found his stride in the stability of judicial life.
And what's truly fascinating here is that while he shared the middle-class fears of social unrest that were so prevalent during the tumultuous 1890s, he wasn't as conservatively rigid as some might assume.
Uh-huh.
He supported labor's right to organize and strike, and even notably ruled against employers in negligence cases. For example, in Voight v. Baltimore and Ohio Southwestern Railway Company in 1897, he ruled for an injured worker.
Okay.
Though that decision was later reversed by the Supreme Court because it violated the then-prevalent liberty of contract doctrine. an idea that individuals should have near absolute freedom to negotiate work terms without government intervention.
Right, that old doctrine.
This shows a certain judicial independence and willingness to side with the individual, even if it meant challenging established economic norms of the time.
That's a powerful contrast, demonstrating a nuanced approach. And then there's United States v. Addison Pipe and Steel Co. in 1898.
Yes. Antitrust.
His opinion, upholding the Sherman Antitrust Act against a pipe manufacturers association, was unanimously affirmed by the Supreme Court and, crucially, definitely and specifically revived antitrust legislation after a period of dormancy.
A big deal for the Sherman Act.
So, you see, early on, his deep commitment to the rule of law and his willingness to grapple with the evolving landscape of corporate power, which would become a hallmark of his executive career as well.
Indeed. Beyond his judicial duties, in 1896, he became dean and professor of property at his alma mater, the Cincinnati Law School, introducing the progressive case method to the curriculum, further demonstrating his commitment to legal education and reform.
Always improving things.
Politically, while a staunch Republican supporter, he was initially lukewarm on McKinley. However, he quickly fell firmly into McKinley's camp after William Jennings Bryan's fiery Cross of Gold speech in 1896.
That famous speech.
Viewing free silver as economic radicalism and a genuine threat to financial stability.
And even in these formative years, his vision extended beyond national borders. From the 1890s until his death, he played a major role in international legal organizations, tirelessly advocating for world peace through law.
A consistent theme.
He was a clear proponent of a world court of arbitration, even suggesting it be supported by an international police force.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this deep-seated commitment to arbitration wasn't just a fleeting interest. It was a foundational belief for Taft. It's a belief that would later put him at significant odds with even his closest allies, particularly Theodore Roosevelt.
Ah, the Roosevelt connection, or friction.
Right. Roosevelt often believed more in military strength and decisive action than in abstract legal agreements for resolving international disputes. This is a consistent ideological thread that weaves through Taft's entire career, defining his approach to global affairs.
Now, that long-standing ambition for the Supreme Court gets put on a fascinating, unexpected detour, the Philippines.
Totally unexpected.
In January 1900, President McKinley called Taft to Washington, not for a Supreme Court seat, as Taft had hoped, but to head a commission to organize a civilian government in the recently acquired Philippines. This was a massive, complex undertaking.
Huge.
And it required him to resign from his comfortable federal judgeship.
Yeah.
It's a truly significant turning point, isn't it? McKinley, however, sweetened the deal by assuring Taft that if he successfully fulfilled this monumental task, he would indeed be appointed to the next vacancy on the High Court.
The carrot.
Taft, ever the pragmatist with a clear vision, accepted, but on the condition that he was made head of the commission, asserting full responsibility for its potential success or failure. He sailed for the islands in April 1900, embarking on a completely new chapter.
He became civilian governor on July 4th, 1901, overseeing the challenging final months of the primary phase of the Philippine-American War. Our sources confirm he approved General James Franklin Bell's controversial use of concentration camps in some areas.
Yes, that's a difficult part of the record.
And accepted the surrender of Filipino General Miguel Malvar, bringing a difficult period of conflict to an end.
What's truly crucial to understand here is Taft's rather progressive vision for the Filipinos, especially for that era. He sought to make them partners towards self-government, though he realistically saw full independence as decades away.
Partners, not just subjects.
Critically, he actively worked to banish the idea of locals as racial inferiors and treated them as social equals at official events, inviting them into his home. This marked a clear and quite progressive departure from the more common colonial attitudes, genuinely aiming to foster partnership rather than just administer a distant possession.
That's a really important nuance, isn't it? Not just administering, but aiming to foster a genuine partnership, which was quite forward-thinking for the era.
Absolutely.
Following McKinley's assassination in September 1901, Theodore Roosevelt became president. Taft and Roosevelt had been friends since the 1890s, and Roosevelt quickly put Taft's diplomatic skills to use, sending him to Rome to negotiate with Pope Leo III.
The Vatican mission.
The mission was to purchase lands held by Catholic religious orders and arrange the withdrawal of Spanish priests, as these landholdings were a significant source of tension and unrest in the islands. An agreement was successfully reached in 1903.
A diplomatic success. Despite this critical work and his ultimate goal of the Supreme Court, in late 1902, Roosevelt offered him a seat on the High Court. But Taft, remarkably, refused.
Turned it down. His dream job.
He did. He firmly felt his work as governor was unfinished, demonstrating an extraordinary sense of duty and commitment to the task at hand, even over his deepest personal ambitions. This really speaks to his integrity.
That deep commitment eventually led him into his next major role, Secretary of War. Roosevelt appointed him to this position in 1904.
Right, a key cabinet post.
The War Department at that time administered the Philippines, which strategically allowed Taft to continue oversight of his previous work. Roosevelt explicitly wanted him as a trusted troubleshooter in difficult situations, a reliable legal advisor, and a prominent campaign speaker as Roosevelt sought election in his own right.
Taft quickly became Roosevelt's hand-picked successor, vigorously defending Roosevelt's record in his numerous speeches.
The chosen one.
However, despite his long-held ambition for the Chief Justice position, he continued to decline Supreme Court offers in 1906, believing the incumbent, Melville Fuller, would live many more years and not wanting to appear to be impatiently waiting for his death.
Interesting calculation.
This calculated patience speaks volumes about his long-game strategy.
The monumental Panama Canal construction also fell under the War Department's purview. Taft visited the site and
help DEA keep our communities safe and healthy by participating in National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day, Saturday, October 25th. Take action right in your own home by cleaning out your medicine cabinet of unneeded medications. Keep them safe, clean them out, take them back. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeBack.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent prescription drug misuse before it starts. That's DEATakeBack.com.
1904, and displaying his knack for identifying talent, recommended Army engineer George W. Goethals, under whom the project advanced smoothly and effectively. This shows his practical aptitude for managing large-scale infrastructure and his ability to put the right people in charge.
His role as a troubleshooter extended beyond the Philippines and Panama to Cuba. In September 1906, after President Tomas Estrada Palma asked for U.S. intervention due to widespread fraud and corruption, Taft declared himself provisional governor of Cuba for 2 weeks.
Just 2 weeks?
Yeah. His stated aim was to reassure Cubans of U.S. intentions for stability, not occupation, showcasing a nuanced approach to regional stability rather than outright annexation or military conquest.
He also remained heavily involved in Philippine affairs, notably urging duty-free admission of Philippine agricultural products to the U.S., believing it would benefit both economies.
Right, pushing for trade.
He even threatened to resign when Roosevelt, facing complaints from U.S. growers concerned about competition, remonstrated with him. Roosevelt wisely dropped the matter, showing Taft's conviction on the issue.
On both of his Philippine trips as Secretary of War, Taft made crucial stops in Japan, meeting with top officials. In July 1905, he signed a memorandum with Japanese Prime Minister Katsura Taro, a quiet but incredibly significant agreement.
The Taft-Katsura Memorandum.
It reaffirmed that Japan had no intention to invade the Philippines, and in return, the U.S. did not object to Japanese control of Korea. This Taft-Katsura Memorandum is a fascinating example of personal diplomacy and a subtle reaffirmation of spheres of influence that profoundly shaped the Pacific region for decades.
Wow.
During his second visit in 1907, there was also an informal agreement to issue fewer passports for Japanese laborers to the American West Coast due to growing U.S. concerns about immigration.
Okay, managing tensions there too. As the 1908 presidential election approached, Roosevelt had publicly declared he wouldn't run again, a pledge he would later deeply regret.
Famously regretted it.
However, feeling bound by his word, he firmly believed Taft was his logical successor and used his considerable control of the Republican Party machinery to aid his heir apparent, even requiring political appointees to actively support Taft or remain silent.
Putting his thumb on the scale, you could say.
Taft faced little serious opposition at the 1908 Republican National Convention, securing a first ballot victory, largely thanks to Roosevelt's backing. However, an early sign of the internal party divisions that would plague his presidency emerged.
Uh-oh.
He was unable to get his preferred progressive running mate and instead found himself with conservative James S. Sherman of New York.
A compromise ticket, not ideal for party unity.
He faced William Jennings Bryan, the Democratic nominee for the third time, who skillfully positioned himself as the true heir to Roosevelt's progressive mantle.
Bryan again. Persistent.
Taft, for his part, supported most of Roosevelt's policies, but sought a more legal and constitutional basis for them. He advocated for a constitutional amendment for an income tax to explicitly overrule previous Supreme Court decisions and specific legislation for trusts. He also opposed Bryan's bank guarantees, favoring a postal savings system instead.
So, continuity, but with a more legalistic approach.
Taft's campaign was somewhat hampered by the public perception that he wasn't entirely his own man. This was fueled by his habit of seeking Roosevelt's judgment on his acceptance speech and other matters.
Yeah, the shadow loomed large.
Roosevelt was so heavily involved that humorous, widely joked Taft actually stood for "Take Advice from Theodore."
Ouch, that probably stung.
This perception certainly contributed to Nellie Taft's growing distrust towards the Roosevelts, sensing the shadow her husband was living under.
You can understand why. Despite these challenges, Taft won comfortably with 321 electoral votes to Bryan's 162, though only 51.6% of the popular vote.
A solid win, electorally.
Nellie Taft, ever astute, noted his lack of political game-playing skill, a trait that would both define and complicate his presidency.
Not a natural politician in that sense.
And in a rather unique historical footnote, Taft was recognized as a Mason at sight in February 1909, just before his inauguration. Interestingly, Ike Hoover, the long-serving White House usher, also observed that Taft's visits to Roosevelt decreased significantly after the election, subtly indicating a growing distance between the two former allies.
The first signs of the rift. And so we move into the presidency, a period often remembered for its complexities and political storms. Taft was sworn in on March 4, 1909, in a rather unusual inauguration inside the Senate chamber due to a severe winter storm.
A blizzard inauguration.
An omen, perhaps, of the turbulent years ahead.
He certainly pledged to maintain and enforce his predecessor's reforms, ensuring they were long-lasting. But his administration immediately marked a definite shift in style. It moved from Roosevelt's charismatic, almost theatrical leadership to Taft's quieter passion for the rule of law.
Different personalities, different approaches.
He simply didn't cultivate the press as Roosevelt had, which contributed to a very different and sometimes less favorable public perception of his time in office. Interestingly, he also retained only two of Roosevelt's cabinet members, appointing Philander Knox as Secretary of State, signaling a clear intention to establish his own team and direction.
Putting his own stamp on things. This personal struggle really highlights a profound, lesser-known aspect of his presidency and must have placed immense strain on him. Very early in his term, in May 1909, Nellie Taft suffered a severe stroke.
Oh, terrible timing.
Leaving her partially paralyzed and unable to speak for a time. Taft, with unwavering devotion, dedicated hours daily to her care and rehabilitation, which took a full year. Imagine carrying that enormous personal burden while simultaneously leading the entire country.
It speaks volumes about his character and personal devotion, but undeniably added to the already immense pressures of the office, limiting his public appearances and undoubtedly impacting his focus.
Absolutely.
In foreign policy, Taft made it a priority to restructure the State Department, organizing it into geographical divisions for the first time, including desks for the Far East, Latin America, and Western Europe.
Modernizing the bureaucracy.
He also established the department's first in-service training program for diplomats, reflecting his belief in institutional efficiency and professionalization, a true administrative reformer at heart.
This reorganization set the stage for what became known as dollar diplomacy, a policy instituted with his Secretary of State, Philander Knox.
Dollar diplomacy, yes.
The core belief was that U.S. investment abroad would mutually benefit all involved parties and strategically reduce European influence, especially in Latin America, where the Monroe Doctrine applied. It was seen as a way to extend American influence through economic rather than military means.
However, this policy quickly drew significant criticism. It was deeply unpopular in Latin America, where there was a palpable fear of becoming financial protectorates of the United States.
An understandable fear.
And it also faced opposition in the U.S. Senate, where many members harbored concerns about foreign interference and the use of American capital for political ends, viewing it as potentially entangling and overreaching.
A major test of his foreign policy came with the escalating Mexican Revolution. Taft initially supported Mexican dictator Porfirio Diaz, even meeting him at the border in 1909, the first meeting between a U.S. and Mexican president.
A historic meeting, but tricky politics.
An assassination attempt was foiled close to the two presidents, highlighting the intense volatility of the situation. When Diaz was eventually ousted and the Mexican Revolution truly began, Taft famously resisted aggressive military intervention despite numerous border incidents.
This sit-on-the-lid approach in Mexico stands in stark contrast to his interventions elsewhere, highlighting the complexities and sometimes contradictory nature of his foreign policy. He was incredibly cautious here, prioritizing stability over direct engagement in a neighboring country's chaotic internal conflict.
Treatments, maybe.
He reportedly told his aide that it would take a great deal to pry me off the lid, demonstrating a deep reluctance to get entangled, a significant decision for a president.
He did intervene more directly in Nicaragua, however, opposing President José Santos Zelaya's revocation of U.S. commercial concessions, which threatened American business interests.
Right, protecting business interests there.
Taft supported rebel forces, eventually compelled Nicaragua to accept a loan repaid from government revenues, and sent troops in 1912, leading to a U.S. occupation that, remarkably, lasted until 1933. This shows the nuanced, sometimes inconsistent application of his dollar diplomacy.
His administration also dealt with the lingering fallout from the Panamanian Revolution of 1903. Roosevelt's lame duck administration had signed treaties to resolve disputes, but Colombia steadfastly refused ratification, feeling it had been wronged.
Still simmering resentment.
Taft, ever the negotiator, offered $10 million, later raised to $25 million, for settlement. However, the issue remained unresolved under his administration, eventually being settled much later.
Due to his extensive Philippine experience, Taft remained deeply interested in East Asian affairs, seeing immense potential for trade and investment. He successfully pushed for U.S. bank participation in a Chinese railroad consortium aiming to expand American economic influence.
Eyes on China.
However, the Chinese decree nationalizing local railroads in response sparked the 1911 revolution. When that revolution broke out, Taft was reluctant to recognize the new Republic of China, preferring concerted action with Western powers, and ultimately left office before fully recognizing it. He also continued Roosevelt's policy against immigration from China and Japan, a complex aspect of his foreign policy.
In Europe, Taft opposed the traditional practice of rewarding wealthy supporters with ambassadorial posts, preferring qualified, professional diplomats.
Merit over patronage, again.
He tirelessly negotiated arbitration treaties with Britain and France, aiming for peaceful dispute resolution for virtually all international disputes, which was a very ambitious goal for the time.
That arbitration theme again?
However, the Senate, which had not been adequately consulted during these negotiations, added amendments that effectively killed the agreements, a major blow to his world peace through law philosophy.
Senate pushback. Familiar story.
This persistent pursuit of arbitration, even when stymied by the Senate, truly reinforces his deeply held belief in legal solutions over military force, a stark contrast to Roosevelt's later views. Despite the failure of these broad treaties, his administration did successfully settle several specific disputes with Britain by peaceful means, including boundary disputes and fishing rights, through arbitration.
Domestically, Taft continued and even significantly expanded on Roosevelt's trust-busting efforts, filing a remarkable 70 cases in his 4 years, compared to Roosevelt's 40 in 7.
More trust-busting than TR, actually.
He successfully pursued cases against industrial giants like Standard Oil and American Tobacco, proving he was no slouch in breaking up monopolies.
However, his antitrust actions, ironically, also deepened the growing rift with Roosevelt. In October 1911, his Justice Department controversially sued U.S. Steel.
Uh-oh, why controversial?
The lawsuit's pleadings alleged that Roosevelt, quote, had fostered monopoly and had been duped by the company, a charge that deeply offended Roosevelt and severely exacerbated their growing conflict.
Calling out his predecessor like that, oof!
A later suit against International Harvester in early 1912, which Roosevelt's administration had previously investigated but not acted upon, also became politically charged, further fueling the former president's challenge. This really shows how quickly a policy difference can become a personal and political war.
Then there was the contentious issue of tariffs and the Payne-Aldrich Act. Protectionism was a core Republican position, and the 1908 platform supported revisions to the Dingley Act, which Taft crucially interpreted as reduction.
Interpreted as reduction. Key point.
He called a special session of Congress in March 1909 to address it, thinking it would be a straightforward path to reform.
The controversy was immediate and profound, becoming a defining moment of his presidency. While the House bill initially reduced tariffs slightly, the Senate, led by the powerful Nelson W. Aldrich, added numerous amendments that actually raised rates.
Raised them, the opposite of what he wanted.
Taft then refused to call the final bill inconsistent with the party platform, which deeply angered progressive Republicans. This is a pivotal moment because Taft's handling of the tariff bill alienated a crucial progressive wing of his own party, setting the stage for future conflicts and contributing to the deep wounds that never healed within the Republican ranks. It showed his rigid adherence to procedure over political expediency.
During that heated debate, when opponents proposed an income tax as an alternative, Taft argued it would be struck down by the Supreme Court based on existing precedent.
Smart legal prediction, perhaps.
Instead, a constitutional amendment was proposed, passing both houses by July 1909, and was eventually ratified as the 16th Amendment by 1913, allowing for a federal income tax. Taft then signed the controversial Payne-Aldrich Tariff on August 6, 1909, to immediate public outcry.
So the tariff was unpopular, but the income tax amendment came out of it. Interesting side effect. He also urged a free trade accord with Canada in 1910, believing in its economic benefits.
Reciprocity with Canada.
It passed Congress, but the Canadian Parliament deadlocked on the issue, and Prime Minister Laurier's government was ultimately defeated in the 1911 election over the proposed agreement. This further divided the Republican Party, showcasing Taft's willingness to pursue policies that he believed were sound, even if they risked internal party harmony or political capital.
But perhaps one of the most damaging domestic policy issues for Taft, and certainly for his relationship with Roosevelt, was the Ballinger-Pinchot affair.
The conservation fight. This was huge.
Roosevelt was a staunch conservationist, aided by his close friend and chief forester Gifford Pinchot. Taft agreed with conservation, but preferred legislative action over executive orders. He replaced Roosevelt's Interior Secretary James R. Garfield with Richard A. Ballinger.
A move that surprised and deeply disappointed Roosevelt.
The core of the controversy revolved around Clarence Cunningham's coal claims in Alaska, which Ballinger, who had previously served as Cunningham's attorney, controversially approved.
Conflict of interest alarms ringing.
A land office agent, Louis Glavis, blew the whistle, going outside the department to Pinchot with allegations of conflict of interest against Ballinger. This was a classic bureaucratic infighting turning into a national scandal.
The situation escalated quickly and dramatically. Taft dismissed Glavis for insubordination.
Fired the whistleblower.
Pinchot, seeking to dramatize the issue and effectively force his own dismissal to gain public sympathy, sent a letter to a senator, leading to his firing in January 1910.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because this incident became a powerful symbol for many progressives of Taft turning his back on Roosevelt's conservation ideals, further driving the wedge between the two former friends.
Absolutely.
A congressional investigation later cleared Ballinger, but revelations that Attorney General Wickersham's report used to dismiss Glavis was backdated deeply embarrassed the administration.
To cover up is often worse.
This entire affair solidified the progressive and Roosevelt loyalists' view that Taft had betrayed Roosevelt's agenda, poisoning their relationship beyond repair.
In terms of civil rights, Taft announced a controversial Southern policy, stating that he would not appoint African Americans to federal jobs, such as postmaster, where it would cause racial friction.
That sounds like a step backwards.
This policy led to the removal of most black office holders in the South, a clear departure from Roosevelt's more inclusive approach. This Southern policy was a significant long-term shift, leading to African Americans beginning to drift away from the Republican Party, a demographic realignment that would have profound consequences for American politics for decades to come.
Wow. Major long-term impact.
He also notably vetoed a bill restricting unskilled laborers via a literacy test, generally supporting free immigration.
So a mixed bag on those issues. Interestingly, Taft, a Unitarian himself, also championed a favorable reappraisal of Catholicism's historic role in America.
Building bridges there.
He praised figures like Junipero Serra and addressed Notre Dame, which helped to neutralize anti-Catholic sentiments prevalent at the time, demonstrating his willingness to bridge cultural and religious divides.
It's also worth noting the extensive judicial appointments Taft made during his presidency. He made 6 appointments to the Supreme Court, a significant number, second only to George Washington and Franklin D. Roosevelt.
6 appointments is a lot.
His first was Horace H. Lurton, an old friend, followed by Charles Evans Hughes, a progressive figure. Crucially, he appointed Edward Douglas White as Chief Justice, the first associate justice to be promoted to that role, a move that would later set a precedent.
Setting White up for the center seat.
This was followed by Willis Van Devanter, Joseph R. Lamar, and Milan Pitney, who faced some opposition due to his anti-labor record. These appointments shaped the court's direction for years to come.
Now we arrive at the pivotal 1912 election, a truly dramatic story of ambition, principle, and a friendship irrevocably fractured.
The fireworks really start here.
Roosevelt's 15-month African trip created a significant, almost symbolic distance between the two men, with minimal communication. Upon his much-anticipated return, Roosevelt privately, and then increasingly publicly, expressed dissatisfaction with Taft's performance, fueling the fire of a potential challenge.
The ideological chasm between them widened dramatically when Roosevelt publicly criticized the judiciary, including the Lochner v. New York decision, which had struck down a law limiting Baker's working hours.
Attacking the courts.
Even more radically, Roosevelt called for judicial recall, a controversial proposal allowing popular majorities to remove judges or reverse unpopular court decisions. This wasn't just a policy disagreement. This was a fundamental clash over the very structure and power of American government, particularly the independent role of the courts.
Yeah, that's fundamental.
Taft, a staunch believer in judicial authority and the separation of powers, was absolutely horrified by what he saw as an assault on the rule of law.
Roosevelt then championed his new nationalism, a robust platform for progressive social and economic reform. He further attacked Taft's administration, arguing it had abandoned Lincoln's party principles for those of the Gilded Age, painting Taft as a conservative out of touch with the times.
Going right after his successor's record.
The Republican Party suffered significant losses in the 1910 midterm elections, losing control of the House and shrinking their Senate majority, further emboldening Roosevelt's challenge.
The weakness, perhaps.
In late 1911, Roosevelt began actively positioning himself for a third term, arguing the tradition only applied to consecutive terms, not a return after a break. In February 1912, he formally announced he would accept the Republican nomination if offered.
He's running. It's official.
For Taft, a loss of renomination wasn't just a political defeat. He viewed it as a deeply personal rejection, a betrayal from his mentor.
As Roosevelt became more radical in his progressivism, Taft was hardened in his resolve for renomination, convinced that the progressives, with their calls for judicial recall, threatened the very foundation of the government and American institutions.
Digging in his heels.
In a truly poignant symbol of their broken friendship, their mutual military aide and devoted friend, Archibald Butt, tragically died in the sinking of the RMS Titanic that year.
Oh, terrible. Caught between them.
It was a loss that profoundly affected both men, but could not bridge their divide. What happened next was unprecedented. Roosevelt, buoyed by public enthusiasm, dominated the primaries, winning 278 of 362 delegates.
Winning the popular vote, basically.
However, Taft skillfully controlled the party machinery, securing delegates from state conventions, particularly in the South, where machines were stronger.
The party insiders versus the voters.
Roosevelt went to Chicago, famously declaring, "We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord," signaling his militant approach. Taft secured Elihu Root as temporary chairman, who made a crucial procedural ruling that contested delegates loyal to Taft could vote on other contested delegates.
A controversial ruling?
Effectively ensuring Taft's nomination on the first ballot. Most Roosevelt delegates, furious, refused to vote, leading to a profound and irreparable split within the Republican Party.
Alleging Taft had stolen the nomination, Roosevelt and his followers stormed out and formed the Progressive Party, famously known as the Bull Moose Party.
The Bull Moose Party is born.
Taft, knowing he faced a near-certain defeat, still believed his doomed run was necessary. He saw it as preserving the Republican Party as the defender of conservative government and conservative institutions, a bulwark against what he perceived as Roosevelt's radicalism.
Running on principle, even facing loss. In this unprecedented three-way race, Democrat Woodrow Wilson ultimately won with a plurality of the popular vote, benefiting from the Republican split.
Wilson walks through the middle.
Taft, adhering to the pre-1888 custom of presidents not actively campaigning, spoke publicly only once during the entire campaign. His acceptance speech. He won only Utah and Vermont, securing a mere 8 electoral votes.
Just 8. A disaster.
Finishing with 3.5 million votes, which was 600,000 less than Roosevelt, and a distant third.
He struggled immensely to finance his campaign, as many industrialists, fearing Roosevelt's progressive policies, chose instead to support Wilson to block the Bull Moose candidate.
money flow to Wilson.
His own cabinet officers and even the distinguished Senator Elihu Root were reluctant to actively campaign for him, highlighting the deep disaffection within his party. To add to the chaos, his running mate James S. Sherman tragically died just 6 days before the election and was hastily replaced by Nicholas Murray Butler.
Just piling on the misfortune.
This election was truly unprecedented, a complete fracturing of a major party, and it all stemmed from that deep personal and ideological rift that defined Taft's presidency.
After leaving the White House, with no government pension to fall back on, Taft initially contemplated returning to law practice. However, potential conflicts of interest were a serious concern for a former president.
Right. What do you do after being president?
He was saved from this quandary by a prestigious offer from Yale Law School to appoint him Kent, professor of law and legal history. He accepted, arriving in New Haven in April 1913, and began lecturing on questions of modern government, finding intellectual solace in academia.
Back to Yale, full circle. He steadily earned money through paid speeches and magazine articles, wisely increasing his savings after the financial strain of the presidency.
And to pay the bills.
While at Yale, he wrote Our Chief Magistrate and His Powers in 1916, a thoughtful and significant constitutional treatise on the powers of the presidency, partly as a reasoned response to Roosevelt's criticisms about the office. This really shows his intellect and his need to clarify the role of the president through a legal lens.
Setting the record straight, in his view. He also continued his public service in other capacities, notably as president of the Lincoln Memorial Commission, successfully advocating for the use of Colorado Yule marble for the memorial.
The Lincoln Memorial.
A full circle moment would see him dedicate this very memorial as Chief Justice in 1922. He was also elected president of the American Bar Association, where he notably critiqued the direct election of judges, reinforcing his belief in an independent judiciary removed from raw political pressure.
Consistent on judicial independence, a significant moment for him personally and professionally came with Wilson's nomination of Louis Brandeis to the Supreme Court in 1916.
Ah, Brandeis. This gets personal again.
Taft, still harboring a deep grudge over Brandeis's role in the Ballinger-Pinchot affair, fiercely opposed the nomination, organizing opposition among ABA leaders and famously calling it an evil disgrace.
Strong words.
Yet, after Brandeis was confirmed and joined the court, Taft, remarkably, came to respect and even like him as a colleague, demonstrating his capacity to overcome past animosity for the sake of professional harmony.
That's actually quite admirable. Taft and Roosevelt remained deeply embittered for years, meeting only once at a funeral for a brief formal exchange.
Just once in years. Wow.
However, a formal and moving reconciliation finally occurred in 1918 in Chicago, a testament to the enduring bond beneath the political animosity. Roosevelt tragically died in January 1919, and Taft wrote movingly, "Had he died in a hostile state of mind toward me, I would have mourned the fact all my life. I loved him always and cherish his memory," revealing the depth of his feelings.
Deep down, the friendship was still there. During World War I, Taft was an enthusiastic supporter of the war effort, joining the Connecticut State Guard and serving as chairman of the American Red Cross's executive committee, where he was appointed a major general.
Contributing to the war effort.
He also co-chaired the National War Labor Board, demonstrating his continued commitment to public service in times of crisis.
As president of the League to Enforce Peace, he fervently supported Wilson's foreign policy and the visionary concept of an international association of nations to prevent future wars, which would become the League of Nations.
Back to internationalism.
However, his perceived flip-flop on whether reservations to the Versailles Treaty were necessary angered both sides of the political spectrum and ultimately contributed to the Senate's refusal to ratify the pact. It showed his continued, yet sometimes politically clumsy, commitment to international arbitration, even in the face of intense political headwinds.
Now we arrive at what many, including Taft himself, considered his true calling, his ultimate professional ambition, the Chief Justice years.
Finally, the job he always wanted.
After supporting Harding's 1920 presidential campaign, Harding, in a rather casual manner, offered him a Supreme Court appointment in December 1920.
Taft, ever the man with a clear ambition and sense of his own stature, stated quite directly that he would only accept the Chief Justice position.
Chief for nothing.
This was a non-negotiable condition given his prior service as president and having already appointed two of the sitting associate justices. He also firmly believed Chief Justice White was keeping the position for Taft, hinting at a quiet understanding.
Interesting inside baseball.
When White died in office on May 19, 1921, Taft sprang into action, actively lobbying for the position behind the scenes, particularly with influential Ohio politicians in Harding's inner circle.
Working the connections, his efforts paid off handsomely. He was named Chief Justice on June 30th, 1921, and in a remarkably swift confirmation, approved the very same day by a 61-4 Senate vote.
Confirmed the same day.
He thus became the first and, to date, only person to serve as both President and Chief Justice of the United States. This truly was the job he always wanted, his professional goal since he was 32, a remarkable second act for a former president, a destiny fulfilled.
The Taft Court quickly compiled a generally conservative record in Commerce Clause jurisprudence. That's the body of law defining the boundaries of federal power to regulate businesses across state lines.
Right, limiting regulation.
Making it difficult for both federal and state governments to regulate industry, and often striking down state laws. For example, in Bailey v. Drexel Furniture Company in 1922, Taft wrote the 8-1 majority opinion, overturning a federal law that attempted to end child labor through taxation.
How did he justify that?
He argued the tax was regulatory, not genuinely revenue-generating, thus infringing on states' 10th Amendment rights, essentially saying Congress couldn't use taxes as a disguised way to regulate things typically left to the states.
Yet he wasn't uniformly opposed to federal regulation. In Stafford v. Wallace, 1922, he upheld federal regulation of stockyards.
Right, the stockyards case.
Finding that animal processing was so closely tied to interstate commerce that federal intervention was indeed justified. This shows a pragmatic, rather than purely ideological, application of his judicial philosophy, recognizing the complex realities of a national economy.
His jurisprudence wasn't uniformly conservative, though, and this is an important nuance. He offered a rare dissent in Adkins v. Children's Hospital, 1923, which struck down a minimum wage for women in D.C.
He dissented there. Interesting.
Taft found the majority's view, which argued that the 19th Amendment granting women the right to vote meant equal bargaining power in the workplace, to be unrealistic. His dissent here is particularly insightful, showing a pragmatic view of economic reality and a concern for vulnerable workers that sometimes transcended his general conservative leanings on business issues, acknowledging that legal equality didn't always translate to economic equality.
In Balzac v. Puerto Rico, 1922, he delivered a significant ruling on territorial law, stating that constitutional protections only applied to Puerto Rico residents if Congress explicitly decreed them, as it was not a territory designated for eventual statehood.
Defining rights in territories, that's still relevant today. Taft also left a significant mark on the separation of powers. In Myers v. United States, 1926, he wrote the 6-3 majority opinion, asserting that Congress could not require Senate approval for presidential removal of appointees.
Strengthening the presidency.
He considered this his most important opinion, effectively invalidating the repealed Tenure of Office Act from Reconstruction and profoundly strengthening executive power, a full circle moment for a former president.
Wow. Undoing a Civil War era law.
The following year, in McGrane v. Daugherty, 1927, a unanimous court found Congress had authority to conduct investigations as an auxiliary to its legislative function, confirming a crucial power of the legislative branch.
When it came to individual and civil rights, the Taft Court laid some foundational groundwork for applying First Amendment free speech and press clauses against states through the 14th Amendment, as seen in Gitlow v. New York, 1925.
The incorporation doctrine starting to form.
Even as they upheld a criminal anarchy conviction in that case, the majority and minority opinions inadvertently opened the door for future applications of the Bill of Rights to state actions.
They also made important rulings on parental rights and religious freedom. In Pierce v. Society of Sisters, 1925, the court unanimously struck down an Oregon law that banned private schools.
Protecting private education.
Upholding parental rights to control their children's education and striking a significant blow for religious freedom, particularly for Catholic schools that were targeted by the law. This demonstrated a strong defense of individual and religious liberty against state overreach.
In United States v. Lonza, 1922, a unanimous court allowed a second prosecution for an act violating both state and federal law. In this instance, prohibition holding that state and federal governments are dual sovereigns.
Dual sovereignty, right. This meant a single criminal act could lead to separate prosecutions by different levels of government, without violating double jeopardy protections.
However, the court's record on racial equality was, by modern standards, deeply problematic.
Yeah, this is a tough one. In Lum v. Rice, 1927, Taft wrote for a unanimous court, which included even liberal justices like Holmes and Brandeis.
Even the liberals?
That excluding a child of Chinese ancestry from a white-only public school did not violate the 14th Amendment. This effectively extended the legality of racial segregation to Chinese students, aligning with the separate but equal doctrine of Plessy v. Ferguson.
Upholding segregation for Chinese students.
This decision, even with the liberal justices on board, is a stark reminder of the prevailing legal views on race in that era and how painfully incremental the fight for civil rights would be.
As Chief Justice, Taft became a powerful and visionary judicial reformer. Unlike his presidency, where he struggled with political leadership, he took an expansive view of the Chief Justice's administrative role.
He really thrived administratively here,
exercising significant influence over his colleagues, famously encouraging unanimity and strategically discouraging dissents to strengthen the court's voice.
He was absolutely convinced the federal courts were inefficient and ill-run. He firmly believed the Chief Justice needed both administrative staff and the power to temporarily reassign judges to address the chronic court backlogs.
Want to clean house, basically.
He lobbied Congress relentlessly for these reforms, and his efforts bore fruit in 1922 with the creation of the Judicial Conference of Senior Circuit Judges, which held its first meeting under his chairmanship. This was a direct result of his proactive leadership to modernize the judiciary.
He also tackled the Supreme Court's notoriously congested docket. He tirelessly advocated for making most of the court's docket discretionary, meaning cases would require a writ of certiorari for full consideration. Essentially, a petition asking the Supreme Court to hear a case, allowing them to choose which cases to review.
The cert petition, still crucial today.
This was a crucial reform to manage congestion. The judge's bill, his brainchild, passed in 1925, and the backlog of cases finally began to shrink, making the court far more efficient.
And perhaps most visibly, he initiated the monumental effort to get the Supreme Court its very own building, rather than continuing to meet in cramped quarters in the Capitol.
The building itself.
He envisioned an independent and dignified home for the third branch of government. Congress finally appropriated funds in 1927, and Cass Gilbert was hired as architect, though the iconic building wasn't actually occupied until after Taft's death in 1935.
He never saw it finished?
Sadly, no. But his vision for an independent, efficient judiciary, culminating in the creation of its own iconic building, is arguably his most enduring administrative legacy as Chief Justice, a testament to finding his true calling in institutional reform.
Now, as we approach the end of his remarkable life, we touch on his declining health. Taft is famously remembered as the heaviest president, peaking at a staggering 340 pounds.
The bathtub story myth.
Yeah. However, by 1929, he had commendably lost considerable weight, weighing 244 pounds due to a rigorous fitness regimen and careful dietary advice.
His commitment to health was evident as he regularly walked 3 miles daily from his home to the Capitol. A crossing over Rock Creek was later, quite fittingly, named the Taft Bridge.
The Taft Bridge. I know that bridge.
Despite these efforts, his health gradually declined over his chief justiceship. In 1929, concerned about the court's future, he expressed a desire to stay on the bench, specifically to prevent the Bolsheviki from getting control, if President Hoover, whom he considered too progressive, chose his replacement.
Worried about Hoover's picks.
This shows his deep concern for the ideological direction of the court, even in his final days.
His health suffered a significant decline in late 1929, becoming quite severe. By January 1930, he was barely able to speak and was, at times, hallucinating.
Really sad decline.
He eventually resigned on February 3, 1930, but only after securing assurances from President Hoover that Charles Evans Hughes, a respected conservative jurist, would be chosen as his successor, again demonstrating his fierce dedication to shaping the court's future.
Managing the succession right to the end, William Howard Taft died just over a month later, on March 8, 1930, at age 72, likely from heart disease, liver inflammation, and high blood pressure.
72. A long career.
He received a rare national honor, lying in state at the United States Capitol Rotunda, becoming the first president and first Supreme Court justice to be accorded such a tribute. He was buried on March 11, 1930, at Arlington National Cemetery, also the first president and first Supreme Court justice to be interred there, a final testament to his unique place in American history.
In terms of legacy, historian Alpheus Thomas Mason argued that Taft didn't receive public credit for many of his policies, especially his effective antitrust work, because he simply lacked Roosevelt's flair and was perceived as boring, honest, likable, but boring.
The personality difference again.
It's incredible how often the most trivial anecdotes, like the untrue story of him getting stuck in the White House bathtub or simply being the last president with facial hair overshadow, truly significant achievements, isn't it?
Indeed, he's generally listed near the middle in historians' rankings of U.S. presidents, often alongside figures like James Madison and John Quincy Adams. Historian Paolo Coletta noted that Taft fundamentally saw the existing order as good during a time that was demanding progressive change, placing him out of step with the prevailing political winds.
Right man, wrong time, maybe.
While historian Donald F. Anderson described his presidency as lacking on-the-job training in manipulating public opinion, a skill Roosevelt had mastered.
Taft's presidential legacy is almost inevitably, inextricably linked to Roosevelt, the man who chose him to be president and took it away.
Can't escape that shadow.
Roosevelt's influential autobiography, published after both men left office, presented Taft with a rather narrow view of the presidency, a narrative that enduringly shaped public perception and, for a long time, overshadowed Taft's own accomplishments.
However, as Chief Justice, he is rated among the greatest. Not necessarily for his groundbreaking legal opinions, which some argue often ran counter to the ultimate sweep of history, but for his profound administrative and reform efforts.
The Administrator Chief Justice.
The enactment of the Judges Bill of 1925 and the tireless work leading to the creation of the Supreme Court building are considered his major and most enduring achievements on the court. As Chief Justice, he was as aggressive and effective in the pursuit of his agenda in the judicial realm as Theodore Roosevelt was in the presidential, a powerful testament to him truly finding his true calling and maximizing his unique talents.
His family legacy certainly continued through his son, Robert Taft, who became a significant political figure and Senate Majority Leader.
The Taft dynasty continued.
And to bring it back to a somewhat poignant note, historian Alpheus Thomas Mason observed that while Nellie Taft has the beautiful cherry trees in Washington, a lasting memorial, William Howard Taft has no official presidential memorial except the Supreme Court building he meticulously planned but died before seeing completed.
Interesting point. No big monument.
Mason questioned if Taft, who was content to wait for vindication, has waited long enough. So what does this all mean for us today?
Well,
so, from our deep dive, it's clear William Howard Taft was far more than just a president caught between political tides. He was a dedicated public servant, a brilliant legal scholar, and a judicial architect who, despite his struggles and the political storms of the White House, ultimately found his greatest fulfillment and most enduring impact as Chief Justice, fundamentally reshaping the federal court system for generations to come.
His truly unique story reminds us that a career's purpose can dramatically shift, and that true impact can be found in many diverse forms of leadership, sometimes in the quiet, methodical work of institutional reform, rather than solely in the charismatic executive.
Right, different kinds of leadership.
It challenges us to look beyond simplistic headlines and conventional narratives, to truly understand the full, complex scope of an individual's contributions, and to appreciate the different ways leaders can leave their mark on history.
And as we consider Taft's lifelong ambition for the Supreme Court and his eventual achievement, it raises an interesting question for you, the listener. How do we balance personal ambition with public service, especially when the path to our ultimate goal involves roles we might not initially desire, but which ultimately shape us profoundly?
Good question.
What unexpected detours might ultimately lead you to your truest calling?